it went straight down the middle. Then it started.
So after the dinosaur, we have our second major of the year, the Merit Club, where, oh, you just snuck in there 2x5 over Meg Mellon and Christy Kerr. You remember lots about that?
I do. I have to say that I was the worst practicer early in my career. Worst preparation. I don't know what it was, but I could never get up for it. I felt like it was really important that it be really good, and it rarely was. And so I'd go into a lot of these events, not even though I was having a great year, not having high expectations because my prep and the lead up to it had been not great. And so that US Open at the Merit Club was one of those weeks. My preparation hadn't gone well. I didn't feel like I was swinging it that great. I started the first hole off very shaky. It was a hard dog leg left, and I hit this block right. Made a really dodgy bogey, and then hold a bomb on the next hole for birdie, and that was it. I was off.
Let's go.
Yeah, and I played great all week. I didn't feel like, walking out the last of the 5-shot lead, I didn't feel like that was a possibility when I made the turn. Meg really was putting the pressure on me, I played a very strong back nine, and she had a couple of not so great holes, a couple of three putts that really she put
give you a bit of room.
Yeah, right. She gave me some breathing space, and so then I could just continue to play how I was playing, and I got to the last hole and had that lead, and it was nice to enjoy the walk up the last.
Yeah, you trailed Meg by one after the first couple of rounds, and then after that third round, 68, you fired. You led by four. Pretty nice winner's share and a nice little bonus on top for winning two majors that year, huh?
Yeah, I had forgotten about that bonus, which is funny because it was back then, $250,000 was a huge check.
Yeah.
That was very nice. I think, obviously winning the US Open was the most special of all of that week. Was I've always held that tournament very highly, to have won it the way I did, was very special.
Yeah, well, this was the US Open in 2000 at the Merit Club, which is up in northwest of Chicago, and I think it was the same day Tiger won the Tiger Slam on the old course, that same day.
It was.
Yeah. Pretty cool part of history, I think. Mm.
Yeah.
So the other thing, when at the top of the show, I sort of alluded to another 7-time major winner that we've talked to, of course, that being Julie Inkster, and a lot of interesting parallels, although she is 14 years your senior, she was
Can
playing
you say that again?
Good,
just in case Julie ever listens.
She is 14 years your senior. She knows.
She knows.
But, to see, and we're going to talk about some of these other wins of yours, but you win back-to-back in the U.S. Open 2000-2001. Who wins the year before? Julie Inkster. Who wins the year after? Julie Inkster. You win the LPGA in 2001. Who wins the 2 years before? Julie Inkster. So that that old lady was doing pretty well back then, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. She was definitely, at the peak of her powers during that time. Yeah.
She was setting records. So you weren't done in 2000 because during this 7-win year, you continued on at the Oldsmobile Classic over Meg Mallon. You won the Aflac Champions at Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail in a playoff with Dottie Pepper. And then you went over to Japan to win the first of two straight at a tournament that I'll let you pronounce.
Nishiri.
The Nicherie
World Ladies Cup, right?
Yeah, Nicherie World Ladies Cup. Yep.
Nicherie.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about before about all these stories we've heard about the Japanese bus trips, and you were saying that you might have caught the tail end of that, but you did have some fun in Korea as well, huh?
Yes, yeah. I think back when I first came on tour, obviously they'd had tournaments in Japan for many years, and at the end of my rookie year, they'd started adding a couple of events in Korea as well. And I think those events, although they were really important, I think they were sort of seen as bonuses to having a great year. Obviously as the years progressed and we had more tournaments in Asia, you really couldn't take a couple of events as lightly as we probably took those ones in Asia. But, if anyone's been to Korea or Japan, you can have a 15 or 20 mile bus ride that can take 2 hours sometimes. Yeah, no, the traffic's really bad. I definitely had lots of fun bus trips in Japan, but my first couple of years playing in Korea, we had, especially on the Sunday, at the end of my rookie year, that's probably the most memorable one. It was the Samsung World Ladies. So there was only, I think, 16 or 20 of us in the field. And all but, I think, Sari Pak were LPGA members. And so there was one or two buses that you could take to go back to the hotel and, along with the caddies. So we were told before we left the clubhouse on the Sunday that that the traffic was really bad heading back into Seoul. the caddies loaded up the bus with, I don't know, 3 crates of beer, I think.
Beverages, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Where's my wine?
And we had a, karaoke machine on the bus and music playing. And, it was 4 hours it took us to get back.
Goodness.
I think it was 20 miles or 25 miles we had to go.
4 hours.
Well, that's at least a 3-beer drive, huh?
Yeah, bus was going so slow, and that we went into this little town, and we were running out of beer. We had enough time.
Stop,
the caddies
we need some more beer.
No, the bus never stopped. That's how slow it was going. The caddies jumped off, ran and bought some more beer, and a few of
caught
us
up with the bus.
Went to the bathroom, and we could walk to catch up to the bus. That's how slow we were going.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So, very, very memorable. I love those trips because we all had to stay in the same hotel, and you got to know players that you didn't necessarily hang out with on a regular basis, and because I think we took them a little bit more casually than a regular event. Everyone was having a good time, and it was a lot of fun. I think it was sort of tailing off around the time I came on tour because we've heard many more
stories.
Better stories than the one I just told you. And that was the PG version of
we've
it.
Heard but, some more. We've heard some fancy ones actually.
I've heard a lot of those, and I was glad I was a part of it because I remember a few years later in Japan. It was always common that for the bus ride home, you'd carry a couple of beers onto the bus in Japan. And I knew things were changing when one year in Japan, I don't know what year it was, but maybe 2004 or 5, when we started having more parents on tour. And I remember getting on the bus at the end of the day with a big Tully beer for our half hour, 45 minute bus ride back, and the looks I got from half the bus on my way back to sit in the back, I was like, yeah, things have definitely changed. It's not the way it used to be.
We've heard so many great stories. I mentioned a couple of them to you yesterday, but and the hidden talents of these ladies, right? I mean, Kathy Whitworth, who knew she was the dancer that we heard she was, and we heard of singers, and of course Amy Alcott, she played golf well. Let's put it that way. They didn't want her to sing or dance.
All right.
So I suppose you could have put your tap dancing and guitar playing skills to work too on these buses.
You kept them up.
Yeah. Actually, even after a few drinks, everyone wants me to tap dance and I refuse. I'm not, I retired those tap shoes.
I see. I would have thought the tap dancing skills would have allowed you to avoid that fall before the Q school, but that's a whole other thing.
Well, yeah, you would have hoped so.
So we finish up 2000, great, great years. As you mentioned, maybe 10 wins worldwide with the Player of the Year again on the LPGA Tour, money leader, Vair Trophy winner, and you're able to carry a torch that year, I understand.
Yeah, that's probably the greatest honor I've been given due to my golfing career was to be a part of the Olympics in 2000 in Sydney. And you know, I had asked if I, you know, because I was going to come home and watch some of the, you know, go to the opening ceremony and watch some of the Olympic events, and so I had asked if I could carry the torch around the time of the opening ceremony, but I got given one of the most incredible honors to carry the torch the last leg of the night before the opening ceremony, and to carry it up the steps of Sydney Town Hall and leave and light the cauldron where the flame stayed overnight. It was an amazing experience. That, you know, they said there was a million people lining the streets of Sydney for the run that night. Everyone was super excited to have the Olympics back in Australia, and it was amazing. Everyone was so into it.
So how long was your little leg that you had to run?
I don't remember. I think it was only like 200 or 300 meters, maybe 400 meters. It wasn't super long. I just remember. So Dawn Fraser, for those of you who aren't Australian or swimming fans, she was one of our greatest ever swimmers and one of the greatest ambassadors to female sport since she retired from swimming. She's an icon in Australia. She was the one to hand the flame off to me, and she had walked her leg and just soaking up the whole atmosphere, and I was quite aware at the time that a lot of people didn't consider golf as athletes, so I was determined that I was running.
I'm gonna run.
I was determined I was running. But friends of mine that were watching it on TV were like, they were yelling at the TV telling me to slow down, you know, because I then had a ton of adrenaline because of how loud the crowd was. And
what a thrill.
It was a big thrill.
And, you know, you cap off that year with a great, great honor like that. You mentioned Dawn Fraser. I think you won the Dawn Fraser Award that year as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I knew how great a year I had, but you know, I really thought Kathy Freeman, who'd won the gold medal for the 400 meters that year at the Olympics, was a shoo-in for it. So I was at the awards just thinking that we were going to cheer Kathy Freeman for winning, and I was completely shocked to have won it.
I think 10 wins, 2 majors is right up there.
Yeah.
Yep. I would say so.
Let's go on to 2001, Bruce. Another good year.
Oh boy, what you keep barely winning these U.S. Open championships. This time you only won by 8. I mean, come on, Carrie. Surrey Pack was second. This was at Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club in North Carolina. Pretty nice score to win by 8 over Surrey Pack for your second U.S. Open in a row, by the way.
Yes. Well, Pine Needles was actually where I played my first ever U.S. Open in 1996. And Annika won that year to go back-to-back U.S. Opens as well. So for me, Pine Needles was the U.S. Open. That was my introduction to U.S. Open golf. And it was the first course that I was going back to and having had played there. So I already knew what I was getting. I already knew I loved the golf course and how it played, and you know, I'd had a pretty decent year till then. I hadn't won, but I'd been playing really quite well, and going off the story that I said in 99 where I didn't practice very well, it was the one times that my preparation was great. The only time that my practice was poor was on the Wednesday, but I think it was just because I felt so ready and I was just ready to go. And, you know, I'd sort of switched off on the preparation because I knew I was ready. And it's probably the best I've played a major from round one to round four in my entire career. So, yeah, I just, you know, that everything fired. You know, the only time that there was a little nerves on Sunday was on the second hole. Terry made a birdie and I made maybe an 8 to 10 footer for a bogey. And, you know, if that hadn't gone in, you know, the day would have definitely been a lot closer. That sort of, even though it was for bogey, it settled me. And I just went to work after that. And, you know, it was 5 shots, but I birdied the last 2 holes. And I think Seri bogeyed 17. So I think I only went to 17 with a 2-shot lead or maybe a 3-shot lead. You know, it wasn't until I made birdie on 17 that I knew that I was, you know, was going to have a nice walk down 18.
Yeah, yeah. Rounds of 70, 65, 69, 69, minus 7. And so that second round, 65, got you a little bit of cushion. You had a 3-shot lead after the second round, but that third round, 69, had you in front by 5 after 54 holes. It was the largest margin of victory in 21 years in that tournament, allowed you to go back-to-back. And there was a young girl that competed, of course, we see her on TV nowadays, took over for Judy Rankin, but 13-year-old Morgan Pressel competed in that U.S. Open.
Yeah, she did. I remember thinking, you know, how is any 13-year-old ready to play in the U.S. Open? But Morgan started a trend for sure. You know, after her, there was many young girls qualify for the U.S. Open, but I think she showed young girls that it was possible.
Well, there weren't many of you on the men's or the women's side that have gone back to back in the U.S. Open. How hard is that pressure-wise?
I think for me, it was. I mean, obviously there was pressure there. But I think because we were going back to Pine Needles and I loved Pine Needles when I played it in 96 and the fact that, you know, I had played a US Open there, I knew what I was getting before I got there. So I could mentally prepare for all the shots prior to getting there, which you don't normally get to do at US Open venue that you haven't played at. So, you know, I think that took a little bit of the pressure off. It took pressure off of the preparation because I think you knew how the course was already going to play. You sort of had an idea where they put pins. So that helped definitely. But I think winning one US Open is difficult and winning two, whether it's back to back, is, you know, even that much harder.
Well, let's go ahead and win an LPGA championship too, Bruce. What do you think?
That's right. Then become the youngest winner of the career Grand Slam that year, 2001 LPGA Championship at DuBont Country Club in Delaware.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Yeah, that was an up-and-down week for me emotionally. Obviously, I just won the U.S. Open. My parents were over, I had a love-hate relationship with DuPont. I because we played there every year for I don't know, maybe my first 6 or 7 years on tour.
Yeah,
and exactly, I either played well there or I played poorly. And
that's strange.
There was no middle ground. You know, I think the confidence I had from the US Open, I started the week off really well. And having my parents there was really special. But halfway through the tournament, my grandfather, my mum's dad, had a massive stroke. And so at first they didn't tell me about it, and then because they thought he might pull through. But then by Saturday afternoon, my parents had got word from Australia that mum needed to get home to have any chance of seeing Granddad before he passed. So, and these are the grandparents that took me out when I was 4 years
started
old.
Started you.
Yeah. So that night, I remember Saturday night sitting in the stairwell. Again, I had a bit of a lead too going into that last round. And sitting in the emergency exit stairwell at the hotel with Dad, and you know, I'd booked them on flights to get out on a Sunday, like, you know, because you know, flights to Australia at nighttime, so they couldn't get out till the Sunday night, but meant that they weren't there to watch on the Sunday. But
Sunday,
Saturday night, I was contemplating not playing the next day and going home with them, and you know, my dad talked me into staying and playing. I really don't have a lot of memory of that round. I think my caddy Mikey navigated me around the course and was really my brain for the day. I had taken my parents that morning. I hadn't gotten much sleep, and I'd taken my parents to the airport prior to teeing off. And you know, my thoughts weren't really at the golf course that day, though, with my grandfather and my mum. So and my grandmother at home. So So it was a happy sad. You know, obviously I achieved a career feat, but my grandfather was passing away at the same time.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something that our listeners sometimes don't appreciate, but they're constantly reminded as we interview
everybody.
Everybody that outside of the ropes, life continues to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for sure. My parents try to shield me from a lot of that stuff, and I get so frustrated with them because, you know, I was like, you know, I don't want to find out days later, you know. I mean, they had to tell me. Yeah. They had to tell me when they were over with me because, you know, mum was aware and she was upset. So
yeah.
You know, but if they'd have been in Australia, I bet I wouldn't have found out until the tournament ended, which would have upset me as well.
Yeah. You know, it's not easy being a parent. You know, sometimes there's just no right answers. You know, either way you go, it's pros and cons. But that must have been a tough thing to play through. You mentioned DuPont, and you know, you would have liked, looking back on that stretch, to have loved the golf course because, as you said, it was played, the LPGA Championship was played there from 1994 to 2004. So there was 11 straight, and a lot of people don't realize that. Same golf course, same major, 11 straight times.
Yeah.
Boy, if you loved it, I suppose you could have a field day there.
Yeah, you could, but I honestly don't. I mean, Jill Inkster won there 2 years in a row. I think Sari Pack might have won there twice. I don't know if Laura Davies won there twice. But no one really played well there consistently. Even if they won there twice, they didn't show up and were in contention every year. I don't know what it was about that course. Yeah. I think there was something frustrating about it, and if you got on the wrong emotional side of the golf course, you're in for a tough week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Annika won there the last time it was there, and then of course she won two more times in succession. But that was when you moved to Bully Rock. But as you say, a bittersweet week with rounds of 67, 64, 70, 69. Pretty good playing at minus 14 and two shot victory, as Bruce had mentioned, over Laura Diaz. We continue on with 2001, and you had victories at Tyco ADT, which was by two over Annika Sorenstam. you had a chance to play this thing that some people, younger people, might not know about, the Battle at Bighorn. Tell us about that experience.
I mean, it was a really great experience. I think I would have enjoyed it more. We had to play it. Annika and I had to play it on the Monday night of the week of the British Open out in Palm Springs. Immediately finishing that. So, you know, we played into the night. So I think we must have boarded a plane in Palm Springs at 10 o'clock West Coast time. To fly, we were playing at Sunningdale. And this was the first year that the British Open was a major. We're playing in Palm Springs, California on the Monday night of a major, and had to fly to London to play at Sunningdale, which, you know, we had played before, so we did know the golf course, but, you know, I think my practice round was the Pro-Am on the Wednesday.
Of course, you know, you knew all this going in, but looking back on it, would you have done it again, or would you have done something different?
I think I just would have enjoyed it. I think, and I can't speak for Annika, but I feel like I know that we both felt our responsibility to do it, because it was women were playing on prime time alongside Tiger and David Duval. You know, it was the top two women in the world with the top two men in the world. I think we knew that our responsibility was to say yes, and that even though it didn't fit in our schedule, it fit in Tiger's schedule, and Tiger was the one driving these events. So, you know, I think I probably still would have made that decision. I think it was hard for me because I'd won at Sunningdale the last time we played there, and you know, it's one of my favorite courses I've ever played. So to not have had the preparation, I think, was difficult. But I think I wish now that I could have just enjoyed the whole experience. I mean, I enjoyed it, but my mind was really already at Sunningdale when I was there playing in it. But, you know, what a great experience. I mean, nothing like that has happened since. It was a fun experience.
So you had a chance to win the Wendy's 3 Tour as well, playing in that one with Dottie Pepper and Annika. So this was sort of a three-person team against the other tours, huh?
Yes. That was the year we won, right?
Yes.
So we'd had a few shots at it prior to that, but I think that was also you know, something that, you know, we wanted to fly the flag for women's golf and the LPGA. So, you know, it wasn't always to be. Those made for TV matches, you know, can go any way. All three of us played really well. I remember I played, with Jack Nicklaus, pair with Jack Nicklaus, in that tournament, which, was a huge honor for me to get paired with him. I never really played great in those TV matches, and I played really well with him. So I was really happy that I did that. And obviously that helped our team win.
Yeah. So let's jump over to 2002, Bruce, a couple more wins in 2002, including her fifth different major.
Yeah. And started off the year with Wegmans Rochester LPGA. Second time you won there at Locust Hill, won over Mi-Yoon Kim, and then Turnberry.
Yes.
Win the British Open at Turnberry, Ladies British Open, two over Michelle Ellis and Paula Marty.
Actually, both those wins have something in common. I really believe in karma and not talking about what you're going to do when you win. Or kind of like if you say it aloud, what you're going to do if you win the lottery. you're never going to win the lottery, you know?
Jinx it. Huh?
So I really believe in people. I really believe in people jinxing themselves. And both those tournaments were the case. So at Rochester, I went into the last day. I think I might have been five shots or four shots behind me and Kim. And Kimmy, it was like one of her first years on tour, and she still didn't speak great English. Worth Blackwelder was her caddy, a longtime caddy on tour. And he was at the time doing a lot of her press conferences. And, you know, he was really, really enjoying the fact that his name was in the paper as much as hers was. And I was sitting having lunch before I went to warm up in the locker room, and I was reading the paper, and I read a comment of Worth that he was going to miss his daughter's high school golf match on the Monday, because he was going to have to stay after the last round to do the press conference with Kimmy because she was going to win. And I read that and I'm like, well, they're not going to win. And so lo and behold, I have this back nine charge, and she had a couple of stumbles, and I was paired with her, and I ended up winning. So that was that one. And then at Turnberry, I'd played well early in the week, and then I think I maybe didn't play well the second or third round, which put me a little bit out of the lead going into the last day, and the weather was supposed to be pretty crappy on the last day. And Karen Koch was leading by quite a few shots, I think, going into the last round. And my caddy was out at dinner with Karen Koch's caddy and his wife. And his wife was talking about what they were going to buy
after the win,
after they won. And Mikey, my caddy, knowing how I was, the first thing he said to me was the story on the range.
Yeah.
And I was like, I go, right, well, they're not going to win.
Fire
and,
up.
Yeah. And so then I just put my head down and went for it.
Just another example of motivation, right?
Yeah.
Well, to refresh your memory, I think you were three behind after that third round. So opening round, closing round 66 at that British Open on a fairly tough track. I would suppose you've probably played it since it's been redone a few years ago.
I haven't actually. We played the British Open there in 2015, and that was right before they redid it. I haven't played it since it's been redone. I've heard though the changes are really good.
I mean, you know how special it is. Well, it's really special now. They've just taken it up a whole nother level. But beautiful track, and that allowed you to complete your super career Grand Slam, as I mentioned, winning your fifth different major now at this point. Now we go into a stretch because we're going to go forward, and the wins are they're not coming quite as readily as they were, sort of at the, you know, that 99-2000 sort of peak. And Bruce always likes to ask about that, doesn't he, Bruce?
No, but Carrie has already mentioned that. If we recall what she said earlier, you know, she's this winning all the time. She didn't realize that there were times when it was going to be a little bit more difficult. She may not have made us handle it a different way, but what was going on? Did you lose your game a little bit, or
outside
influences?
Maybe a little bit of outside influences, but nothing that I hadn't been able to turn off before. It was just, when I won the US Open in 2000, I earned enough points to qualify for the LPGA Hall of Fame. And I think around that time, like, I was a big goal setter, and, you know, to me, the Hall of Fame is the pinnacle of our sport. And so even though I was still trying to set goals, nothing was really grabbing me, you know. And so I didn't have these big carrots dangling in front of me that I was chasing after anymore. And then I also didn't have a great process of what rewarding myself with little wins rather than having just these big goals. You know, I didn't have these little wins along the way. And so I just was really a little bit lost for a couple of years because of those two things, not anything else, I don't think. I think anything that was going on outside of golf, I could have handled, but I just was a little bit lost and didn't know what direction to head in. So it was really just about learning those processes and getting back to giving myself pats on the back instead of punches in the face if it wasn't good.
Well, something must have clicked again because you come into 2006, you have 5 wins in 6, and you open up the year with another win at the Dinah Shore. This is your second one. This is in a playoff with Lorena Ochoa, another fellow Hall of Famer, with rounds of 70, 68, 76, 65 finish for -9. You had an interesting way of getting into that playoff, though, didn't you?
I did. And I guess another little motivation prior to playing. I wasn't actually – I'm going to say I was reading the newspaper again before I went out to warm up, and I was. And it's funny because I've told that twice now, and I was hardly ever a regular newspaper reader because I didn't want to read anything that would upset me in the paper. But I was reading the paper. I was 7 shots behind starting Sunday. I'd not won on the LPGA for the first time in my career the year before. And I was probably the lowest I'd ever been at that point in confidence in my game. And I'd put myself in a position to be in the last group on Saturday and hadn't played well. And I was trying to give myself a bit of a pep talk before I went out, thinking 7 shots behind, I didn't really have a chance to win, but I had a chance to have a good week and that would, you know, hopefully start a run of good golf again. And so I was just reading the paper, trying to chill out. I had a few minutes to kill. And I read that the local reporter had noted that Annika Sorenstam, who was 10 shots behind, because there wasn't many people between her and I think Lorena was leading.
Yeah, Lorena was 9 under, and so Annika must have been 1 over, I guess.
Yeah, she was 10 shots behind, but there was probably only 6 players or something between her and Lorena, and or 7 players. But they said that, you know, Annika wasn't out of it. She had a chance 10 shots behind. And I was like, well, if she has a chance at 10 shots behind, I have a chance at 7 shots behind. So,
absolutely.
So that's sort of how I left the locker room. And, you know, I still don't think I gave myself a solid shot, but, you know, I got off to a good start and, you know, made the turn. And I think I was fairly, maybe 2 shots off the lead by the time I made the turn. So, you know, I just went from there. And then, I played the back nine in contention and, you know, had a bit of a slow middle part of the back nine. I think made some really key up and downs. And that was just, now I've put myself in this position. Do I have the courage to play well? Not feeling as confident as I had in the past. And then got to 18 and it was the first year that they had decided to move the tee on 18 up to the very front tee to possibly make it reachable. And in practice round, I was like, I don't think I'm going to hit it long enough down here unless we have it blowing downwind that I'll ever be able to go for this with anything but a 3-wood. And it's an island green. I'm not ever hitting in here with a 3-wood. Anyway, the decision was taken out of my hands off the tee. I missed the fairway, so I had to lay up. And had a perfect, you know, grip wedge, smooth grip wedge at 116 yards. And at this stage, I was tied for the lead. I thought I need at least one more to get into a playoff. And put a great swing on it. Started at the pin, never left the pin, and a couple of bounces that went in the hole. all hell broke loose.
I bet.
And then I was Yeah. Very un-Kari Webb-like was described, my reaction to to how it all transpired from there. But I honestly, when I hold it, I thought I'd won.
And you got into a playoff, right?
Yeah, by the time I got into the score tent, Michelle Weir had made a birdie on 16 to go to 8 under. So I thought, you know, I'm going to be in a playoff here. So I had to get calmed down from that high and get ready for a playoff. And in all the years after that playoff, and all the years I had a chance to go for the green, I only ever went for the green once. And that was in that playoff. And it was only because Lorena Cho had hit it 30 or 40 past me and was definitely going for it. I think she only had a hybrid in her hand. And
yeah,
I was in between a 5-wood and a 3-wood. And the 5-wood was never carrying the right side. So I'd said to Mikey, what's behind the green? Because if I hit 3-wood at the left, it's going to go long. And he said, I've already looked there. There's long grass back there. It'll stop the ball for sure if it goes over. And so I hit the 3-wood, and that's where it went, long, long left. Lorena hit it long right, just through the back where she could putt. So I had a really, really difficult chip and hit it to about 8-9 feet. And Lorena busted her putt way past. She must have hit it 12 foot past. And then missed her putt, and then I made mine to win.
Pretty cool story. You got yourself into the playoff. You didn't know it at the time. You thought you'd won, but to dunk one for eagle, and then to birdie that same hole to win, was to be your seventh and final major in a playoff against Lorena at the Dinah Shore, which is for anybody a pretty special place to win.
Yeah, it was. And ironically enough, in the off season prior to that tournament, I had a dream that I had a 8 to 10 footer left to rider to win Dinah Shore. So all off season, that's what I practiced. This is to win Dinah. This is to win Dinah. And immediately after I hold that shot in regulation, I was like, oh, I guess I didn't need to hole a 10-foot left to rider. And it wasn't until after I hold the 8-10-foot left to rider to win that I realized that I'd actually dreamed it, and then I actually lived it for real. So it was very, very special and surreal at the same time.
You mentioned what you'd read in the newspaper about Annika's chances, and we always called that we call that locker room material, right? Something you're going to put up on the locker room to motivate the team before the game.
Yeah.
So once again, another example of motivation that you found somewhere.
Yeah, I definitely had a knack of finding those things.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.